Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 87, section 5. We got into the sectional ways. It's on old single column, page 963, and it is paragraph number 8, right after that large paragraph break there, about two-thirds of the way through. Okay, so we have this very significant finale to this section, as I was saying at the end of the preceding session. But just remember where they've taken us. They've, you look at the title of this section, The Advancing Ghost Cult, and what that means, you know, in a simple way, is that you've advanced at least to the addition, if not the replacement, of spirit for ghost. You know, either you have both spirits and ghosts, or you maybe have kind of really started to move away from ghosts in general and are thinking more just in terms of quote-unquote spirit beings. But again, all in this ghost cult, you know, dreamscape, illusory origin system that that humans constructed. However, remember how they, in this section, as they were, you know, pointing out that the more you get a very definitive height to the hierarchy of this scheme, the more human identification with that scheme has very, very sweeping, significant consequences to how we behave. This so-called spiritual identification has very significant social ramifications, social consequences. Just think about what they were saying in that last paragraph we read last time. Remember we were in that mode with the evil eye, in other words, with the envy of the ghosts or the spirits, and everyone is very, very concerned about not doing anything flashy or whatnot, or seemingly prideful or selfish or whatever. And, it starts out very crude, but like they said there, eventually, this sort of, as they're saying, depreciating behavior evolved into civilized modesty, restraint, and courtesy. So that, and we were making sure that we all appreciated, or were beginning to try to appreciate, how really all of the refinements of civilization that we have had their origins in this completely illusory scheme that was, we believed was compelling us. Okay. And we took it very seriously, and long after any sort of person who in the secularized days, of recent centuries, has left behind the literalness of the ghost cult, or direct fear of some boogeyman spirit being or whatever. Nonetheless, they've convinced themselves that there's a place for modesty, or there's a place for restraint, or there's a place for courtesy. And so this is just yet another reminder of how we progress in spite of ourselves. And as we're stressing, oh, so much of, technically how it is that for a million years humans have progressed in spite of themselves. The how of it is the mechanics of this illusion, these illusions of the ghost cult. That's the key answer, really, to all of the tempering of our animal origin nature that we've achieved so far. Okay? And, you know, it may seem like a minor issue if someone maybe isn't as modest now as they were 150 years ago. Okay, and some, you know, very objective, from some very objective vantage point, okay, there's some validity to that. It's not the end of the world in and of itself that someone maybe is a little less modest. But the fact that's slipping, the only way it got into play was all of this intense superstition with the ghost cult and stuff. You know, do we really want to go back? Because, you know, we can't have illusions about, pardon the pun, about illusions again, but we can't have illusions about that we're somehow just going to magically impose modesty or restraint or courtesy on ourselves. We're too primitive genetically. And we would have to go back to some very harsh cattle prod-like system like we talk about so much in so many different ways, you know, to get us to the point where we would moderate our behavior again. And, you know, it may not be the literalness of the ghost cult of old, but it will be some ideology that everyone becomes very, very amped up about again, you know, and anyone straying out of the lines of it is immediately burned at the stake or whatever. I mean, you know, it's that harshness that, you know, was made it vivid enough that people moderated their behavior. So, you know, it's all, you know, we want to keep that in mind. Now, on the positive side, even in the midst of your fellows slipping, you don't have to. And you can challenge yourself to go forward with the help of the revelation and produce that inner character that is self-moderating. And to do that, one needs to reflect very clearly on some of the key elements of your potential cosmic character. That, you know, the key ways you speak of that cosmic character, the words that you use to describe that cosmic character, and get those words that we've had for a long time out of the ghost cult, so that you can hold them up anew, and they can become a lure, an objective lure for you to begin a quest towards that will lead to the growth in the cosmic character that, you know, is effectively the law written in your heart, as the ancients spoke of, you know, and that democracy is predicated on. Right? If the law isn't written in the heart to some degree, there can't be democracy. There has to be some sort of a authoritarian or totalitarian external, you know, regime. Okay, so that's where we are. You can see you've got a list of italicized words coming up. That's what I was just referring to. Some of these key things, and we want to consider them in the ghost cult, and then begin the process of thinking about what they might be outside of the ghost cult. All right, so let's see what they've got here.
Under the spirit cult, life was at best a gamble, the result of spirit control. One's future was not the result of effort, industry, or talent, except as they might be utilized to influence the spirits. The ceremonies of spirit propitiation constituted a heavy burden, rendering life tedious and virtually unendurable. From age to age and from generation to generation, race after race has sought to improve this super-ghost doctrine, but no generation has ever yet dared to wholly reject it.
Let me just start with that very last little statement, because I stated that in advance, you know, last time or the time before. See, but no generation has ever yet dared to wholly reject it. And when we talk about that, this key wineskin of the ghost cult, and even if you do like they're saying here, you know, you notice they started out, they didn't say ghost cult, they said spirit cult. Like I said, you know, you may have advanced to really, it's more of a spirit cult now than a ghost cult, technically. You know, but you know, that spirit cult, quote unquote, is a super ghost cult. You've come up to it, you know, by exalting the ghost cult. But the fact that that's the basic worldview framework that our civilization exists in, this is a big part of the challenge to get to the fifth epical revelation, is to see that spirit cult, super ghost cult, whatever you want to call it, framework for what it is, and try to step out of it, and to start with the highest concepts, right? Because it doesn't matter if you try to get the lower concepts out of that. If you don't have the higher concepts out of it, you aren't really going to get the lower concepts out of it. You've got to start at the top, try to get out, to get into a genuinely new frame of reference. Okay? And, you know, they're just stating it point blank there. Don't think that someone has ever done this. It hasn't happened. No generation. Okay. I mean, sure, you can talk about some exceptional individual, but that's lost in the noise. Right. Effectively, this hasn't occurred yet. You can't look to someone's prior or even current frame that they're putting out as an alternative and think, oh, there it is. That's the out of the old wineskin frame. There isn't such a thing out there. That's what the book is here for. And the degree to which the book appears to be in one of those existent frames is the degree to which you haven't found the truth of the revelation yet. Okay, so there's that. Now, notice the little thing they're throwing in there that should, if you're paying attention in recent years, decades, should sound familiar, right? Because if we are slipping back, we're going to start to think in the old ways, only, you know, like in some new secularized modality, like I was saying, instead of, you know, the old time modality. So when they say that, you know, back in the day with the full on spirit cult, that one's future was not the result of effort, industry, or talent, except as they might be utilized to influence the spirits, that should remind you of the voices in certain ideologies today that tell you, you think that you have been industrious and that's led to your success. But the priest in that ideology, that secular ideology, says, no, you didn't build that. You know, that was, you know, you're just living off the backs of the system that, you know, bestowed this upon you. You know, and they might even get into the specifics and say, well, you know, except to the level where you schemed the system, you know, and that's what your industry, you know, has directly led your success, that whole bit of utilized to influence the spirits. You know, the spirits just become the gatekeepers of the status quo system. Okay. So, I mean, we very much have that. And I'm sure you've heard politicians not only say stuff like that, but you've heard politicians say things like, that successful person over there, you know, they just won in the lottery of life, you know, or some expression like that. See, all that, you know, way of talking about things or thinking about things, rationalizing things, see, they don't even recognize it in their secularized state, but they're still in the old wineskin of the ghost cult. You know, they think they've thrown out the ghost. They've thrown out this imaginary God character, but they're still in the frame, and they still speak in the terms of the frame. You know, life was at best a gamble. Right? Yeah. You just, you know, everyone's rolling dice and, you know, that person just got lucky, you know, at the crap table or whatever. Yeah. So just notice that, how, and keep noticing that. Keep, you know, the more you kind of remember what they tell you about the ghost cult here, the more, you know, you will hear the political voices just, you know, repeating these ways of thinking about things. It's inescapable. It's just because all of this ghost cult stuff is natural, remember, you know, to such a degree. So, I mean, humans just naturally will think like this, even if they've thrown out God. Okay, so now there's a, you know, notice that the thing they're emphasizing, this incredible burdensome effort that everyone was under to propitiate the spirits. You know, and you might have laws and regulations now that, you know, are incredibly burdensome, and, you know, because you're trying to propitiate the powers that be. Okay, in a more secular mode of this way of controlling ourselves, if you will. Okay, so and just that fact that it was getting more and more and more burdensome, and people like Jesus come along and tell you that you can know the truth, and the truth will set you free from all of this burdensome framework. You know, not surprisingly, we're feeling burdensome by the complexity of our society, and again, and there's a revelation in my lap, trying to give us the good news again that humans don't have to, you know, load all of this stuff on their shoulders like they tend to do naturally. You know, as they try to, you know, somehow dot all the I's and cross all the T's and be found, you know, up to par, you know, with the current schemes of society, mores of society, you know, and are accepted by society. All right. Okay. So that's how they start us out here with that. Let's see what else they give us here, kind of as a predicate before the meat of it here.
The intention and will of the spirits were studied by means of omens, oracles, and signs. And these spirit messages were interpreted by divination, soothsaying, magic, ordeals, and astrology. The whole cult was a scheme designed to placate, satisfy, and buy off the spirits through this disguised bribery.
Okay, so you've got, you know, the propitiation thing, you know, and then kind of in general, you know, keep in mind here this whole issue when all is said and done, you're trying to bribe the spirits. You know, that's the scheme. Well, again, you think about how this plays out. I mean, the intention and the will of the spirits were studied by, you know, all that sort of stuff. Think about, if you watch TV, all the talking heads there that are trying to, you know, they've dedicated their lives to being experts in the ways of the Fed or something, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank or of Congress or whatever. And they will go on and on and on, you know, in their divination mode, right, as they try to prophesy about, you know, what's going to happen, how this is going to work, and how, you know, whether or not you should buy or sell your stock or whatever. Okay? I mean, see, we're just naturally in that kind of mode. You know, we're always looking for some oracle.
If you're going to Google, let me know.
You know. I mean, there's a guy from the center of the country who's very wealthy, is a big name in the stock market. They call him the Oracle of Omaha. Right? Right. So, I mean, we see it's a very natural mode to be in that. You know, and there's as much validity to all those experts, you know, with their economics degrees or whatnot, as there is to the Oracle of Delphi. Okay, it's just as arbitrary in general. You know, don't let the mathematics or, you know, advanced degree fool you. Right? In general, we're still in a very primitive mode. But we like to imagine we're not.
Well, they do have a lot of risk programs out there.
So yeah. Right, you know, we do statistics. Yeah, we do statistics now, you know, and of course there's some validity to that. But
tossing bones.
Right. But when all is said and done, you know, see, you know, the very fact that you use statistics, which is predicated on a random foundation, that's all life was at best a gamble. Yeah, see, you know,
even the thought adjusters study your before they come to evolve, you know, within you, they're given a pattern of your history and, you know, and what you might be like and so on. So they actually do look at things and make a decision on how they're going to devise your career before they even start, right?
Again, so I'm not saying that you shouldn't look. But what I remember, this is just the same conversation we had with insurance, you know. The book is not saying that you should sell your insurance policies, but it is challenging you to add something above that mode of thought where you're listening to the stock expert or purchasing an insurance policy. That there's a mode of human existence above that that is less predicated on this assumption that life is at best a gamble. Right? And then you're just kind of just subject to the whims, only not of the ghosts or not of the spirits, but, you know, the acts of God, quote unquote. Right? To begin to think in a more personal acting mode rather than being satisfied lower in that reacting mode.
True.
You know, that's the challenge. Okay, because we're not setting up a dichotomy here. The book is just trying to challenge us. You've stalled out and are satisfied at too low, an ascension level. You want to keep pushing higher.
Disappointments should challenge you.
Right.
That's kind of the beauty of it.
To get, you know, to not just be satisfied with gathering data and rationalizing it in the ghost cult model or any other model, right? And doing all of these insurance policies and gurus and whatnot within that scheme, but to challenge yourself higher in that.
Throw Watson out the door.
I mean, to actually go to seek genuine knowledge, not just rationalized data, right? But to discover again that there's a higher quest than rationalized data. There's something called knowledge and wisdom and truth, right? And those are quests that are short-circuited the moment you're satisfied with a rationalization of information, right? And when all is said and done, there's no difference in rationalizing it, you know, with current physics theories, or rationalizing it with the ghost cult, or rationalizing it with astrology, like they're saying here, right? You see this whole bit. These spirit messages were interpreted, right? They're rationalized. You come to an understanding of them, right? And you don't care about the issue. It's like, well, is it a true or a false understanding? It's just an understanding. You're satisfied. End of story. You know, whether you understand it with astrology, you know, or soothsaying or whatever. Quantum mechanics, general relativity. Right? If you're satisfied with the interpretation of the data about GPS system with general relativity, then you've just short-circuited your ascension scheme. Because that's not the final word. General relativity is predicated on false initial assumptions. It doesn't matter that it precisely rationalizes, you know, all this stuff with the global positioning system. You've got to that whole bit about soothsaying. Remember what the word sooth means? That's truth. That's truth saying.
With a lisp.
Yeah, it's just the old way of saying it, right? Like forsooth, right? Right? Okay, that's the word truth, right? You see, you had people, they were seeking truth, and they thought they found it when they got to a truth sayer. Okay, you know, and like they're pointing out, all that person is, it isn't really truth. They want to use that word because there's this word and we want to apply it. But what that person is just an expert at rationalizing data in the accepted scheme. And if they give you a rationalization where every I is dotted and every T is crossed, we call that true. Because we have some sense that the word true is some way holistic, like, you know, complete like that. But see, no, I mean, it's not, it's an understanding, but it's a false understanding. Truth is something transcendent of whether or not it's a completed understanding or not. Okay. So note that too, that they're, you know, they've mentioned this whole bit of this propitiation and the whole bit of bribery and then truth here and stuff. Right, that's leading up to our list of key concepts to reflect on anew. You know, and then there's even a little bit of a tongue in cheek there in that sentence. The whole cult was a scheme. So like I was saying, I mean, see, that's, we have this vague drive to want to find the whole that the parts exist in. But see, you can, as they're pointing out with the ghost cult, this quote-unquote whole that you construct within which everything is understood, right, that wholeness is all about placating, satisfying, and buying off the spirits. And you've got to want to be satisfied with something genuinely transcendent of that notion. Okay, so go ahead and read the little preface line and 1, 2, and 3 all together here.
And thus there grew up a new and expanded world philosophy consisting in 1. Duty, those things which must be done to keep the spirits favorably disposed, at least neutral. 2. Right, the correct conduct and ceremonies designed to win the spirits actively to one's interests. 3. Truth, the correct understanding of and attitude toward spirits and hence toward life and death.
Okay, see, so notice the preface there. And thus there grew up a new and expanded world philosophy. That's that framework that everything's going to be understood in. And you've got these three key elements. So you start with duty. Because of the shadows cast down in your mind from your encirclement in the Holy Spirit above, you know that duty is something significant, but you just don't know how or where or what the deal is with it. But duty, you know, you've got to put that in a key seat in your scheme. Okay, so what is it in the ghost cult scheme? See, those things which must be done to keep the spirits favorably disposed, at least neutral. See, so that's the propitiation mode. And you just want to get it so they're favorably disposed. We're all kind of leaning forward here. You're not fighting against them, pulling back on you. Right, they're at least neutral. Okay, propitiation. So that's the concept. That's what duty is all about. Is to neutralize basically the bad luck stuff coming from this so-called spirit environment.
Yep. Would sacrifice come under duty, you think?
We'll talk about that in a second. Just, you know, we need to bring in the other one too. I mean, before we get to some specifics like that. Okay. See. So just notice. See. That's just, like they're saying. You know, it's at least neutral. Okay. But to take it beyond that, that's when the concept of right comes into play. See. You notice that. See. The correct conduct and ceremony is designed to win the spirits actively to one's interests. Okay. So it's one thing to just kind of get them favorably disposed, but whoa, can I actually get them, you know, directly to assist me in an active way? Okay, and see that these people, there's a logic to all this, right? It's obvious to them that that's taking it a step further, and so the word for that is a more significant word than just duty. Right? It's not just, you know, your duty. This is the right thing to do. You know, you say, and you know that's, you know, that feels like a heavier thing in your mind. You don't really know why, but, it, you know, you just know, okay, that when you say it, it's the right thing to do, you know, that's a weightier thought. Okay? And see, and you're thinking, well, you know, that weightier conformity is going to get you more. Right? It's going to get them actively, you know, aligned with your interests. Okay, so now, and the details, like say sacrifice, right? That gets into this, you know, how exactly a particular scheme is rationalized in detail. Whether or not they think that a sacrifice is going to get, you know, spirits favorably disposed, you know, or is it actually going to, you know, get them into an active mode? You know, that's going to depend upon the scheme, the details of a particular scheme. Right. Exactly, you know, where that fits in, some of those details, you know, fasting or sacrificing or, you know, an infinite number of things you might do, you know, just where that fits into the scheme precisely.
So what's the difference between this right and the right that your thought adjuster admonishes you to do?
Yeah, right. Well, we'll get to, yeah, we're, well, yeah, there's nothing but difference. Okay. Yeah, and we'll get to that in a second. We're just, we want to flesh out the ghost cult part first here. Yes, this is as in right and wrong. Yes. Or, you know, in the abstraction, righteousness. Okay. What do you mean by righteousness? Okay, and then truth. Okay. An even more rarefied thought. And you can see that mode was, you know, instead of just the correct conduct, like righteousness, this is the correct understanding. You know, so this is a little bit more about, you know, your final mental state, if you will, you know, or sensibilities about these things as you thought them through. Okay, before we go any further, I just, you know, they've already taken it from ghost to spirit in each of these. You know, see, to keep the spirits, to win the spirits, you know, understanding of spirits. Okay. Take it another notch to where it is in the world view you were born into. Duty, those things which must be done to keep God favorably disposed, at least neutral. You know, right. The correct conduct and ceremonies designed to win God actively to one's interests. Truth, the correct understanding of an attitude toward God, and hence towards life and death. Those are our current definitions. Right? We've just replaced ghost by spirit and then by God.
And that in itself is an advancement.
It's an advancement, but you know, it's you're still stuck basically in the old wineskin, right? You haven't gotten to the real God. You've gotten to a ghost that's as glorified as possible, and hence most hinting at the real God, more than just a ghost does. Okay, but it's still a bottom-up, quote-unquote, God. It's not the real God that's reaching down. You know, It's your notion of the immaterial exalted, as opposed to the genuine spiritual that's reaching down. You know, so if you let's assume the best of it. Let's say you this God concept that you've gotten by this bottom up process is taken right up to some ceiling. Okay, but you can't get through that wall of that sphere you're inside of. It requires a genuine leap of faith to get around to the other side. No amount of attempts to additionally exalt this bottom-up concept is going to get you through. You've gotten up to the ceiling. It's like no amount of biologic evolution takes things any further, and biologic uplifters have to come and lift you up, give you a leap of biology, right? The same thing is true here. All you've discovered by getting to the wall is that you are in the same bubble you started in, that ghost called bubble frame. Okay, so, think about how up in Paper 16, Section 6, duty is immediately given a place. They say there's these three cosmic levels that you can consider. Those levels, you could label those levels causation, duty, and worship.
Even in the screen papers,
right? And of course, duty is all over in the book, right? But just noting it, there that that relative to the second cosmic intuition, the moral discrimination, they've designated that level with the label duty. You have a moral duty. You have a duty to the cosmos. It has nothing, as I point out all the time, genuine morality has nothing to do with other things and beings. It has to do with just one object, you, and whether or not you are in conformity with the cosmos or not. As a matter of fact, all three of these things, duty, righteousness, right, and truth, are in different ways of understanding your conformity with the cosmos. All right, when you read the three-section essay that follows Paper 16, Section 6, about the three cosmic intuitions, right, they tell you right away that righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Is righteousness correct conduct? No. See,
Not completely, but...
Yes, completely no.
Really? You think it doesn't end up in correct conduct?
There are fruits of the Spirit, of course, but the righteousness itself is not the fruits. See, what we want to get to the inner life. See, they're defining righteousness in the outer life. The correct conduct. Right? I can observe someone's conduct. I can't observe someone's righteousness, really. Righteousness is a state in the inner life. I can suspect there's righteousness when I examine the fruits of the Spirit that you manifest in your conduct, but that conduct is not your righteousness. God doesn't care about how you're moving your molecules around or other molecules around or what the hell. Okay? That's not righteousness. Right? Righteousness is inside. It can't be observed by anyone else.
Can you recognize it in yourself?
Eventually you can become if you take delight in cultivating a reflective relationship to yourself, you will come to discover in retrospect, remember you can't know about growth during the process, but you can discover it in retrospect. Oh, I've grown. See, and genuine growth is growth into conformity with the cosmos. You can recognize that upper domain, the more reflects the universal harmony of the cosmos than it did before. You might suspect that in yourself because you noticed that you conducted yourself differently in a very similar experience. You go, where did that come from? Was it just random that I conducted myself differently? You reflect it. No, I can follow that conduct back in and up. Oh, it comes from my upper domain. My upper domain is new and improved. I see now as I reflect upon myself. That conformity with the cosmos. And righteousness is not correct conduct. But that's the definition in the dictionary, because the definitions in the dictionary are the ghost cult definitions. How could they be anything else? Okay, that's how we define these words, is in the ghost cult. Okay? And then truth, that ever more rarefied concept, again, that has something to do with conformity with the cosmos, a holistic nature, a holistic state of mind, frame of mind. But this says that truth is the correct understanding. That's what the dictionary says. No, that is not what truth is. Truth doesn't have anything to do with the correct understanding. Just like righteousness doesn't have anything to do with, you know, directly with correct conduct. Okay? And that, when you get to truth, that's where you're going to be fully challenged. What is truth? Said Pilate to Jesus. When Jesus told him that, those who love the truth, everyone who loves the truth recognizes my words. Or something to that effect. Yeah, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but about something about like that. Right? And Pilate goes, truth? What is truth? What is truth? If truth isn't correct understanding, see, right now that's the way we use it. If you have some experience, you have some data, some information, you rationalize it in the accepted frame. It's properly rationalized in that frame, so it's a correct rationalization, we call it, right? And in the fullness, it's a correct understanding, so we say that that interpretation is true. If you think that's what the word true means or truth, when you're reading your Rancho book, you're in the old wineskin, and you haven't found the revelation of truth. Isn't that ironic? If you're going to find the revelation of truth in this, you probably need to start with the word truth. Because if you think that this book is a revelation of a correct understanding, you're in the old wineskin. Right, and your thought is going to be to beat someone over the head with the correct understanding instead of the one that you say is, the correct understanding. I have the correct understanding. It's like, no, truth doesn't have anything to do with the correct understanding. So quid est veritas? What is truth? Let's just, we won't go forever on this, because basically I can't explain truth to you. You need to eventually experientially discover this. But I can give you some hints. Let's think about the difference between truth and righteousness. We could even throw in another one that I often talk about, thinking of it like a sphere. There's another one, holistic one, logic. And you use the word logic when you're talking about that holistic mode of validation, in contrast to the other two modes of validation of faith and reason. Then there's truth. So, again, like I said, all of them think in this, you might visualize it as a sphere. It's kind of a simple way to visualize holistic. In this conformity to the cosmos, to have a state of mind in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind or self that is true, you're speaking about it has this holistic, spherical, if you will, full conformity with the spherical wholeness of the cosmos. It reflects it, that state, and it's in its wholeness, in its fullness. That's the truth of that state of mind. And it's very dynamic. You can obey truth. Add that little thought too. Now, so if that's kind of the wholeness, well, what's righteousness then? When you go to righteousness, you're bringing in your active exercise of your personality. Like when we talk about putting yourself in cooperative subordination to the whole, to the Paradise Trinity, that cooperative, your will is involved. Even when you look in the threefold actuality with the unity chart, you see righteousness down here in the personality block. Okay, so you have that wholeness, but then when you are exercising your genuine personality, which technically only functions relative to that wholeness, see, so that you have this free will purposing of that wholeness, then you can talk about righteousness. When they say righteousness is conformity with the cosmos, it's in that sense. But logic and truth speak to that wholeness of conformity too, in slightly different ways.
Yep. So are these concepts that you're talking about, which are hard for me to get my hand around right away?
They should be, right? Yeah, none of us should be able to figure this out right away.
So my question is, is this something we'll be figuring out for eons?
You'll be figuring this out forever. Because as soon as you come into a synchronization with the whole, the whole gets bigger, if you will, right? It's an eternal journey.
Basically laying out what it is, but the actual really experiencing of a being, in your own life. For me, anyway, at our level, we can experience certain parts of it to a certain degree, but not to the degree you're talking about in terms of, that seems to me would take an awful long time or really under, a lot more growing of our soul, being in contact with the part of God within us and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's all, all the mechanics of an ever-expanding process.
Is that truth embodied in the thought adjuster then, or not?
The spirit of truth has truth embodied in it. This adjuster is the spirit of goodness.
Okay.
And the Holy Spirit's the spirit of fact. Now, the point I was going to bring up here, this whole bit about how, it's like, Chris seems to be saying that there's sort of this hierarchical relationship to truth. And it's an endless journey as you move higher and higher up in the infinite hierarchy. Yeah. But you might ask a curious question. It's like, well, why? Because, here it was saying truth is this, like I was saying, the correct understanding of an attitude toward God and hence toward life and death. And if I take the Urantia book, God, so I have this purely existential being. Is this saying that truth is just something that is totally removed from the facts of time? And it's just, off there in existential eternity? No, because again, there's truth appears on the chart here again, this threefold actuality with unity chart. There's the existential triplet of beauty, truth, goodness. That was the truth thing I was just kind of alluding to there, that you can maybe kind of get from the fullness of the ghost cult notion of truth, maybe. But then there's this truth here, in field number two. Fact, truth, goodness. Okay? A truth that's tied to fact. In a way that the truths of eternity are tied to the facts of time. Well, if it's tied to the facts of time, that means that, it's reaching down and it spans the whole hierarchy of facts. Right? There's the facts that are apparent to me right now, and then there's the facts that'll be apparent to me when when we've transcended God the ultimate. you know, and we're in the co-absolute, okay, and we're in the cosmos infinite. Those are going to be, you know, quite the facts, okay? You know, see, this incredible fact that truth comes down and engages facts, that there's this experiential conduit that brings truth down from the existential and makes it immediately accessible to you relative to facts, the facts of time. Right? And see, and it's that's the truth that you want to be directly challenging yourself to find a synchronization with. The kind of truth that's predicated on the facts of time. Why? Because I can trip over the facts of time. That's much more immediate to me. Okay? The cosmos is this system, some objects of which I trip over, right? This conformity with the cosmos, right? That's what I'm looking for here, okay?
I just had this vision of someone who's supposedly wise, you know, tripping over things.
Yeah. Yes. We have, you know, the absent-minded, you know, sorcerer-like guy, you know, right, is supposedly the wise one. Yeah. Maybe not, because he always is tripping over things, right? Okay. Go ahead.
So, and I mean the main sort of difference between a ghost cult sort of whole and the real whole. It's just that the ghost cult whole is sort of all self-derived, like a collective self-derived illusion, system of rationalization that's all based on illusion.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in a way, you know, they use the word truth, so you're still being true to that. You're still being, you know, righteous according to that. So it's not like there's so much difference, except that you're transferring that when you make that big step, you're transferring that to the cosmos instead of a system of illusion.
Yeah, and I mean, you can even say that the current ghost cult definition of the word truth isn't in fact the definition, but in truth it's the definition, yeah. Which is another way of saying what you're saying. See? Right, because again, we have by grace a vague, fuzzy relationship to the essence of this stuff, but we need to get to the substance of it. You know, the substance is not the substance we've always thought, this illusion, which is not substance at all. We need to get to the reality, the actual substance of these concepts, and that's the challenge that's being put forward, and so. You know, we have true and false tests, right? You know, go, oh, yeah, I see. Those are correct understanding tests. Those aren't actually true and false tests. Those are correct and incorrect understanding tests. You know, at best, sometimes we even use truth in an even more diminished sense. It's just, you know, whether or not something is a fact or not, you know? Right, so, and I often point that out. A lot of times people use the word truth kind of in that mode where it's just really, what they really are talking about is their attempts to relate to quote-unquote facts, and there's always this subjective bias. There's your facts and there's my facts, which are truth. Right? Even diminished from this, from the little more abstract concepts of a correct understanding. You've just kind of totally collapsed to the individuality things that you think you're poking or not, or pointing at or not.
How does that fit in with Jesus being the truth for his time and generation? Is that just sort of like way beyond my concept?
Yes. It's what I'm trying to get at is, then you start thinking about all the passages you might remember that use the word true or truth. It's like, So what is that passage really talking about? What is a revelation of truth? Remember, truth cannot be defined with words. I've got a great big book full of words here that says it's a revelation of truth. And then it also says that none of the words are that truth. So what is truth? That's the challenge you want to put forward. And again, the other thing about, to add to what you were saying about trying to understand the ghost cult definitions compared to what the revelation is trying to get us to recognize, like I was pointing out with righteousness, so much of the ghost cult concept, even though it uses words that are inner life words, they're rationalized as elements of the outer life. Righteousness is rationalized as some, you know, a quality of the outer life. It's not. It has nothing to do with the outer life. It's an inner life word. Because, totally inner life. Remember, the lower domain in the hourglass analogy is not personalized. It's only the upper domain that's personalized. And I was just telling you, righteousness is like in the personality block here on the chart. Okay? Right. It exists only in the genuine inner life, the heart, the genuine heart, the upper domain, not in the lower domain, and certainly not in the molecules moving out there and with your body in the external world. Okay. And truth is the same way. Right? Truth does not exist in the lower domain of your mind. It's not in the domain where you see and hear and touch and feel, and it's transcendent of that. It's in that upper domain. And there's a hierarchy in that upper domain of it. You begin by knowing the truth. And then subsequently you obey the truth. And eventually you culminate in thinking the truth. And that's something that's called genuine worship. Or it's called philosophizing. And it's something that the masters of philosophy teach you on the Isle of Paradise, and then you put into practice and are conducted in by the conductors of worship, the conductors of thinking the truth, the conductors of philosophizing. So like, wow, I got to really take my word philosophizing up a couple notches. I probably don't want to think about, Kant or something here. Or worse. Did you have something, Gene?
Well, I'm just thinking, collectively, if you're trying to put together rules that are in conformity to the cosmos, what would you call it? Would you not call those rules righteous rules? Is there a better term to use?
Robert's rule.
Well, think about how in part four they kind of speak to this question. It's like, well, okay, so, you know, if I decide something and act upon it, am I righteous? Well, what does it say there? That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. Well, that doesn't help me. It seems like I could do anything. Yeah, you see, again, righteousness is not about your conduct. Right? You know, your decisions are, decision forms in the lower domain, are intentions that make your body move and interact with other people and things and stuff. Okay? That's not righteousness. Now, righteousness is about that state of that personal living philosophy in the upper domain, and it's how well it reflects the harmony of the cosmos. And then there are fruits of the Spirit. Right? There's fruits of that upper domain that come down in the lower domain and manifest outward in the external world. But those fruits, no matter how glorious they are not the truth, not the righteousness. Those are just the fruits. Again, it's the reason you should be thinking, oh, I think I know another reason why that these are the definitions in the dictionary, the ghost cult ones, these outer life kind of defined ones. What Chris is talking about is so abstract, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Right? See, and that's the thing. I mean, we're talking about something that is very abstract. somehow you got to back up away from all the things that you can really kind of wrap your mind around to some source essence that is as yet not examined in you. Right? Because again, if this was examined, I could look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary. One of those key elements, like in some sense, a nucleus of that upper domain. You know, the nucleus about which the sphere of truth exists. And the fact that I can't even look up the nucleus, of course I can't look up what might be wrapped around that nucleus, the word truth. This is the challenge, like they just said. But no generation has ever yet dared to wholly reject it. Because if a generation had, the UB's definition of the word faith would be in the dictionary. But it's not. Right? The definition in the dictionary is a lower domain thing, you know, which is, you know, in relationship to the external world, you know. Is your associating mechanism to your, you know, to your outer life. You know, it's about belief. The word faith is about belief in the dictionary. Beliefs are in the lower domain. It doesn't mean that you can't have beliefs predicated on the upper domain, but right. Right? I mean, you can have beliefs that are predicated on genuine faith, but still the faith is not the belief. It's something very abstractly transcendent of the thing that you can wrap your mind around. You can immediately think you know what you're talking about, the belief.
Yeah. So the faith of the ghost cult would be the correct belief?
Well, and of course, you know, in the ghost cult, you know, what do you eventually have for the word faith? I say it all the time. Faith is defined as credulous belief. Right?
Or a philosophy.
You know, it's a belief that you think is so transcendent that it's beyond understanding and just is there. Right, and it flies in the face of all understanding. Right, the more credulous it is, the more you know it's faith. You know, so the thoughts go. We'll see that here in a little bit when we read about how humans get into that kind of way of rationalizing the word faith.
The faith just passes all understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, well, okay, see, again, it's like yes and no, right? See, right? I mean, faith is separate from logic or reason, okay, but faith is not unreasonable or illogical, see? And that's what we get mixed around, right? You know, we think, oh, I finally have found faith because I've found something completely unreasonable and illogical. It's like, no. No. You know?
So it's magic.
Yeah, you know, it's just, it's that same thing that, you know, we see all the time. Like, God is love, but, you know, love is not God. Our God is good, but goodness is not God. But not all goodness is God. You know, there's a technically precise way to say it.
Can I say one thing?
Yep.
I just wanted to say how much I love the lower domain, that it's a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm really into the lower domain right now. I really appreciate it.
Right.
It's so solid and
yeah.
Wondrous in its own way.
I mean, if there wasn't something very positive about a lower domain, we wouldn't have it.
Where decisions are, like, decisions will get us to the upper domain.
I mean, think about, you know, when they talk about your conformity with that adjuster, it's decision forms that technically conform to the adjuster.
Right.
So are decisions important to you? It sounds like it. It's like, I'm going to forget about decisions. I'm just going to do choices. It's like, well, there is no. No. You have to actually, because the adjuster is down in the mind, those are mindal decisions, right? It's the mindal decisions that are in intimate contact with the adjuster, not the more transcendent choice. The choice isn't sort of immediately wrapping around the adjuster. the choice is above the adjuster, just like it's above your mind, right? The adjuster is always subservient to your will, subservient. It's a below those choices, right? It's the decision forms, right? Those grounded feeling things, you know, where the rubber meets the road. Through the mystery of mysteries, that's what's wrapped around the adjuster.
Yeah, and there's no skipping over the lower domain.
No.
And just one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
The seven absolutes of infinity are the anchors for the lower domain.
Yeah.
Like, that's profound.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Like, they're not some, like, little home league. They're, like...
Yeah, no, they're very important, right? That lower, you know, and you go, well, wouldn't, you know, the fact that the lower domain could go off so squirrely, why, I mean, why didn't God make some anchors, like some absolute anchors for that? Yeah, good news, he did. There's seven of them, right? And that domain can be very anchored.
Yeah, and like, they really know what they're doing.
Yes, right. You don't have
to worry, just think about them.
Right.
So it's amazing, though, how it's the lower and upper. It just amazes me.
Mm-hmm.
This discussion makes me think about this building that they're putting up next door and how they spent so much time, it seemed like forever, you know, preparing to put the foundation in and preparing and then beginning to put the foundation. It took forever, each step carefully, going through preparing the part that wasn't even ground level yet, you know, for so long. And then they started putting up, you know, above ground level.
Right.
It sounds so much like this conversation.
Right. Or, the you know, when Adam and Eve came, why? And because, I would like to have a greater relationship to truth, you might say. Well, okay, there's an issue. You don't have a foundation for a greater relationship to truth. That's why Adam and Eve's come, to lay a better foundation so that greater truth can rest upon that foundation. It's like, well, can't I just have truth with, you know, with the Swiss cheese foundation I have? No. Well, God can make square circles. No, he can't. Right? It's the same thing. Yeah, that's why they come to every world. You have to have a better foundation to build a higher structure upon it, you know. And if anything, see, if I try to build too high a structure, like if I try to bring my adjuster into play too much on my Swiss cheese foundation, it's not going to be pretty, right? I don't have the appropriate foundation to have much of a relationship to an adjuster right now. And so that's why the revelators say, don't go there, okay?
They called it
that's dangerous.
Picture,
trust everything, you know. The relationship to the adjuster you need, it will happen superconsciously. Don't get carried away with trying to have some conscious relationship to the adjuster, because you're trying to build a 100-story building on quicksand, and the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
They do say that one of the great challenges is for us to try and listen to the voice.
Yes, but again, we don't interpret everything in this life. Right? See, that's all those things are true. But factually, they're spread out over a whole career. Right? They're not. Remember, they tell you don't try to cram everything into this one. Okay, especially those very advanced spiritual things. Don't try to cram those into this beginning career. You know, you can try to cram it into the beginning career to a high degree when the world is in, you know, fifth stage of light and life or something, okay? But right now, post-rebellion and default, we have a very limited foundation. The relationship you need with the adjuster, by and large, is given to you by grace, by the spirit of unification. It's taken care of. You know, start with the foundation. If you want to talk about those three spiritual ministries you're trying to engage, Holy Spirit, Spirit of Truth, Thought Adjuster, start with the foundational one. It's not the Spirit of Truth. That's a pretty recent thing. It's not adjusters. No one gets those immediately at conception or birth or something, right? No matter whether or not you're post or pre-Pentecost or anything. Right? The foundational one is the Holy Spirit. Take delight in cultivating. Start there. Build the foundation. Take delight in cultivating. And the more you're grown upon that foundation of your relationship to our local mother, the more naturally, automatically, the Spirit of Truth and the Thought Adjuster will chime in. You know, they will contribute. You don't have to go seeking and try to compel their addition, because that's the ghost cult mode again that we're just about to read about. Okay. Okay. I think we've enough said about that. But that it was important that we spend quite a bit of time on that, because that's a very, very important. You know, like I said last time, you would never. You know, it's like, well, I wonder if there's a spot in the book where they really are trying to get me to directly think about what I think righteousness and truth are, and compared to what they should be. Oh, I know, it's probably in the ghost cults paper. Yeah, no, you'd never think to look in the ghost cults paper unless you were really on your game. It's like, oh, well, you know, we probably, our definitions are probably in the ghost cult frame. That's probably where they talk about it. That would be logical. But we aren't that logical, so we don't think of going to the ghost cult paper first. Yeah, and of course we go to something where they're talking about the existential truth, beauty, goodness thing, and that gets us too focused on the existential, right? Where we're too heavenly minded, we're no earthly good. You know, that has to be balanced. All right.
It was not merely out of curiosity that the ancients sought to know the future. They wanted to dodge ill luck. Divination was simply an attempt to avoid trouble. During these times, dreams were regarded as prophetic, while everything out of the ordinary was considered an omen. And even today, the civilized races are cursed with the belief in signs, tokens, and other superstitious remnants of the advancing ghost cult of old. Slow, very slow, is man to abandon those methods whereby he so gradually and painfully ascended the evolutionary scale of life.
You know, of course, we've already been talking about that, getting out of the old wineskin. But at the same time, the way they say it there, oh, well, you know, I probably should be cautious about burning bridges here. If I don't have something to replace, I probably better not throw everything away. It's like I was saying before, it took a million years to get us here, despite ourselves. If we use our will and throw it out by fiat, you know, in a day, and do not have the wisdom to replace it, then what? Then civilization collapses. That reminded me, too. The other little thing I didn't pick up the loose end of. Remember how I was telling you, don't forget about how they were speaking about the bribery thing? You know, that disguised bribery? You know, just think about the duty and the right, you know, number one and two there in that list. See, and it's just two different modes of bribery. And that's important as we go forward into this next section, to keep that in mind, that this is, we're steeped in this notion. We don't think of it overtly as bribery. It's disguised bribery. But it's bribery nonetheless. All the things that we do to be religious or spiritual or whatnot, you need to step back and look closely at those things. Like, oh, I'm just trying to bribe some notion I've got. If I do this, God will, you know, show favor upon me or whatever. And to try to get, you know, we'll eventually get to the paper, whole paper on prayer, remember? That's where it gets really challenging in this regard. To try to think of prayer apart from the ghost cult, apart from bribery.
Or making a deal.
Or, to be more specific, like coercion. Yeah, and you'll see the deal thing is going to come up here. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so let's read a little bit more.
Section 6, Coercion and Exorcism. When men believed in ghosts only, religious ritual was more personal, less organized, but the recognition of higher spirits necessitated the employment of, quote, higher spiritual methods in dealing with them. This attempt to improve upon and to elaborate the technique of spirit propitiation led directly to the creation of defenses against the spirits. Man felt helpless indeed before the uncontrollable forces operating in terrestrial life, and his feeling of inferiority drove him to attempt to find some compensating adjustment, some technique for evening the odds in the one-sided struggle of man versus the cosmos.
Notice how they threw in there just saying it that way instead of saying man against the spirits, but man against the versus the cosmos. Like I was saying, they didn't have it correct in fact, but they had it correct in truth. There's a truth there, right? There is this intangible cosmos that you have to synchronize with, just like the illusory ghost or spirit world was intangible, right? The one little thing I just want to highlight there, you know, they put the quote-unquote higher spiritual methods. You know, and again, this is the way it goes. The more we recognize that there is a vertical nature to us inside and we project that outward into this ghost cult, it's like, okay, to agree, that's fine. It is getting us to think upward about the reality beyond us. Okay, but we want to have a relationship to that higher domain, and we don't think in quality terms, right, as material creatures first. We think in quantity terms. And so the higher spiritual methods are ever more complicated schemes to we think put us into relationship to these higher levels. And so they get more and more elaborate. When genuinely to go up, you know, you're going up first in quality terms, and then kind of quantity or capacity follows. Okay, but we, you know, in the bottom up mode, we always are thinking in quantity terms, and it really biases, like. You do a word search and you find that something only occurs once in the book. You think, well, that's a minor point then. Okay, but the thing that occurred many times, well, that's a major point. See that no. You're thinking in quantity terms. Just because it occurs only one time in the book doesn't mean it isn't infinitely transcendent to the thing that occurs 50 times.
About the truth of the book here.
Right. The word count is the facts of the book. Okay.
In the early days of the cult, man's efforts to influence ghost action were confined to propitiation, attempts by bribery to buy off ill luck. As the evolution of the ghost cult progressed to the concept of good as well as bad spirits, these ceremonies turned toward attempts of a more positive nature, efforts to win good luck. Man's religion no longer was completely negativistic, nor did he stop with the effort to win good luck. He shortly began to devise schemes whereby he could compel spirit cooperation. No longer does the religionist stand defenseless before the unceasing demands of the spirit phantasms of his own devising. The savage is beginning to invent weapons wherewith he may coerce spirit action and compel spirit assistance.
Okay. I'm feeling pride going before a fall here. But as they're pointing out, okay, this, you know, we progress in spite of ourselves. This, there's a positive aspect to this, but all good things, you know, in their proper evolutionary context, taken to extreme, become bad, and that's why I'm saying that I feel a prideful fall coming here. But let's just think a little bit precisely that the way they say that, you know, may coerce spirit action and compel spirit assistance. Just, you know, using the coerce and compel in contrast like that. So the more literalness of the word coerce is you're surrounding the fact, you know, it's like, okay, you're mine. I've got you here. Okay, and now I'm going to drive you together. I'm going to compel you. I'm going to drive you together with me, right, in a specific assistance that I desire. You know, but before you compel, you have to surround the fact. You have to coerce it, right? You know, and this, you know, the reason that they put that coercion there up, you know, rather than, you know, something like, you know, compelling, you know, compel the spirits or something, is just to think about how grandiose we think these schemes that we invented are. That I do something, and okay, God is mine. Okay, he's got to do, you know, what I desire here, because, you know, I've surrounded him. You know, and you go, well, I don't ever think like that. Are you sure? So when you're reading in the Urantia book and you read about the first moral choice, do you interpret that in the ghost cult? The answer, of course, is yes. It's the only way you can interpret it to begin with. So you interpret it in the coercion mode. Oh, I make a moral choice, and that coerces God. I've got him. It's like, now, God, you have to send me an adjuster.
Wait a minute, who thinks this?
That's the only way you can think about it.
You mean if you're looking back on yourself or people you know?
Think about how you interpret. What does it mean when they talk about the first moral choice? Is this some conscious thing that you do and hence wrap your hand around God, and now he's got to send you an adjuster? No escaping, God. I've got you. See, that can't be what it's talking about. That's the ghost cult. Right? So what are they talking about, this first moral choice? People have heard me talk about this before. I mean, you're struggling until one day you notice, you know, there's this one spot in the book. Well, if it was important, it'd be in lots of places, Chris. No, it's one spot in the book where they refer to unconscious choices. You're going, what? that doesn't make any sense. Kind of going hand in hand with the ghost cult stuff is your thought that your entire mind is your conscious mind. No, that's a very limited part of your mind. Most of your mind is an unconscious domain. And that doesn't mean it's outside of your mind. It's your mind. But most of it's an unconscious domain. Okay? You know, in particular, there's that superconscious, you know, part of it. That's an unconscious domain. That first moral choice, see, again, it all ties to this whole, what does the word moral mean? Oh, well, that's the first time as a little kid, when I became aware of the taboos that my parents have taught me, and I conformed to them, and I made my first moral choice. No, it has nothing to do with that outer life conduct and the taboos and mores, all this stuff. See, it doesn't have anything to do with that. Right? That moral, again, is another word that's talking about a conformity with the cosmos. Now, that first moral choice is the choice that your personality made when it identified with your mindal self.
Example.
What are you talking
about? I'm talking about something, right? You've got a mindal self that a personality hasn't identified with yet.
Yeah, but what are they talking about?
The first choice is... Okay, you have the creative mother spirit puts that up, makes an upper domain that's moral, right, that's in conformity with the cosmos, right? And then this personality comes from the Father and identifies with that moral domain. It chooses that. It's a first moral choice.
So your personality is not even there before you make that?
The choice is to be there, to be identified with you. That's that first moral choice.
So before that, the personality is...
Okay. It's not something that you're conscious of where you go, oh boy, I could have been selfish there, but I wasn't. No, see, again, selfishness and stuff is not what we're talking about.
You had nothing to do with it.
Right, you had nothing to do with it. Because, see, and you go, well, no, I can't believe that. No, I had to have something to do with it because God obeyed and sent an adjuster. No, see, you're thinking in the ghost cult again.
Yeah,
you're thinking about...
Old, you're not thinking
right, well, but people now, reading the Urantia book and trying to figure out when, at what point they were making their first moral choice when they were a kid.
Oh, yeah, you've been reading the same thing I have. I
know, I don't have to be reading the same thing. Everyone's been talking about this since the Urantia book came to this planet, right? Everyone's been thinking about this for decades, right? It may pop up in public, you know, discourse amongst readers every once in a while, but no, see, that's the ghost cult interpretation of the first moral choice. You aren't coercing God to send you an adjuster. I mean, you got your encirclement of the Holy Spirit by grace, not by coercion. You got your personality by grace, not by coercion. You got the Spirit of Truth by grace, not by coercion. You got the Thought Adjuster by grace, not by coercion.
It's a lot of grace.
Right. It has nothing to do with you praying. It has nothing to do with you, you know, consciously choosing, doing correct conduct, having a correct understanding. Right?
So can you make that first moral choice without your personality?
No, choice is what a personality does. A mind can only make decisions.
So that's what I mean. So when you do make that choice and your thought is accomplished, it's because your personality engaged your mind.
Well, see, just the way you said that, see, basically what we mean by you, you know, when you're saying what, when you make, you know, when I make, when one makes, I mean, that's your mindful self makes decisions. Okay? See, again, it's trying to remind you of how abstract personality is. You know, personality is transcendent of self that makes decisions. Personality is not even an object, right? And it makes choices. Choices are transcendent of those decisions, right? Because your personality is a spirit pattern. And spirit is transcendent of your entire mindful self. Right? See, you know, that upper domain isn't your personality. How do I describe what's in that upper domain? That's personalized mind. Or a personalized self. Right? It's a mindful self that's under the influence of a personality, but it's not the personality. Right? See, literally, see, is under the influence of, right? That personality is an influence from eternity.
So that personality survives even if you don't.
Right, that influence from eternity survives. Because, you know, if it's above what goes to iniquity, right, it survives, right? It's not subject to, you know, it was the influence that drove this self to iniquity, but it's not the iniquitous self. Right? That influence, that measure of influence from eternity, that measure of spirit pattern goes into the summation of God the Almighty.
That's interesting. So that's why if you have a supreme adjuster who's been in a lot of people, you eventually are aware of the personality, I guess, of all those people that didn't survive.
Well, you're not aware of the personality, but you're aware of the meanings and values that were related to those that didn't survive. Right? The character, maybe you could say, if you will. Right? And you could reflect upon what kind of an influence from eternity might have led to the experiential development of that. of those meanings and values that the adjuster possesses and that you eventually become aware of. But
so your personality, it's not you, is it?
No. See, that's the thing. When you say you, see, what you're really talking about is your mind or self. Right? That's where your consciousness is. Right.
But it is you in a way. It's just a way you can't really relate to. I mean, it's like, because it stays the same as you change. Right?
Your personality is this gift you've been given to be able to direct yourself from above. Right? Or even in a simpler sense, it's a gift you've been given to allow you to observe yourself from above. It's the gift of an observer. And from that observer vantage point, it can then direct from above. It's a way that you don't have to be just a helpless victim. You know, your mind or self doesn't have to just be a helpless victim of antecedent causation. You can intervene and say, no, my personality chooses to have this overriding influence superimposed on my mind. I'm not just going to just be there and like, well, whatever hits me. I hope it's good luck and not bad luck. You know, it's just a crapshoot this life, you know. It's not in that moment. See, that's what I was trying to get at. See, no, you have a personality. You can take over control of your mind. You can intervene between that which is external that's trying to get at you, and you can filter it. I'll let that in. That's the harmony of the cosmos. I'll let that in. No, you're not going to let that in. You have control. You don't have to be a helpless victim of antecedent causation. See? All right. Where were we? I guess we were there in the early days. Is that where we are?
Man's first efforts.
Is that where? Okay, let's see. Oh, that's right. We did read that. Okay, so let me check. Okay, yeah, that's right. The negativistic. It's kind of how we ended. Notice what I was just saying about personality. No longer does the religionist stand defenseless. See, there's a truth to that. Okay, it's not in the silly illusory spirit, ghost cult notion or whatever. Okay, but yeah, you are no longer defenseless. That's what they keep trying to tell us here.
Yeah, it reminds me of Jesus talking to the apostles about, why don't you take the kingdom by force like the heathen lay siege to a city?
Yeah, and the kingdom is your upper domain. I mean, you have sovereignty there. Take it. Choose. This is my domain, and I dictate, what's there. And I will not allow pollution in my upper domain. No longer will I drag the ghost cult god up there. No more. And nothing in the universe can counter that. Right? There's no infinite fact that can counter that, because there's an absolute dimension to your personality which can hold an infinite fact at bay or let an infinite fact in. I mean, a little at a time probably would be wise. Right? Like that infinite adjuster fact. Probably want to let it in a little at a time. Right? Okay.
Man's first efforts at defense were directed against the ghosts. As the ages passed, the living began to devise methods of resisting the dead. Many techniques were developed for frightening ghosts and driving them away, among which may be cited the following. 1. Cutting off the head and tying up the body in the grave. 2. Stoning the death house. 3. Castration, or breaking the legs of the corpse. 4. Burying under stones, one origin of the modern tombstone. 5. Cremation, a later day invention to prevent ghost trouble. 6. Casting the body into the sea. 7, exposure of the body to be eaten by wild animals.
So when you think about, you know, the northern white race, you know, in general doing cremation, see that a later day invention, see, it's a more sophisticated thing, that those more sophisticated people have gone down the path to that thought relative to lesser peoples.
Well, it's only done today because it's cheaper.
And now the thing about this is, you know, we may not, you know, do much of this in a very overt way, you know, but think about how we love stories, you know, that are all predicated on the ghost cult rationalizations. Like, okay, if you've got a vampire, I mean, you got to cut the head off, right? I mean, yeah, we know these things, right? You know, about vampires. You know, how do we know those things? Well, cutting off the head, see, to prevent ghost trouble. We keep some of these schemes in play through our stories. You know, and sometimes those stories aren't just, you know, more fanciful, like vampires and werewolves and whatnot. But, you know, well, no, this is real stuff. Now we're talking about the devil and demons and this is real stuff, you know, we say. But you end up, you know, if you think about movies, you know, you don't be surprised if, you know, in order to eliminate the Antichrist, you got to chop off his head or something, right? Because it's all the ghost cult scheme. And don't you love the, you know, it gives you a whole new sense, especially the tombstones that are flat plaques on the ground. That'll seal him in there. right, bury him under a stone. You might even wonder why sometimes a very evil thing that no one could kill in a movie, coincidentally, some great big stone lands on it, and finally, you know, you're done with it. I mean, a lot of times, see, the person that wrote that scene doesn't even have to have any conscious hearkening back to these old thoughts. They're natural thoughts. You know, everyone can reinvent them all the time. You know, we talked before about the whole cremation thing with, you know, and how Jesus' empty tomb just, you know, adds to that whole part of the ghost cult scheme.
And Chris, people are afraid to go to graveyards because they fear that there'll be ghosts everywhere.
Sure, yeah. I mean, we all know that for a lot of people, we've gone up to spirits, but we haven't left ghosts behind. Ghosts are still, you know, the things that frighten you. You still whistle past the graveyard, or at least walk a little bit faster, or something. You know, you can even think about when it isn't, you know, sailors that have no option but to bury the body at sea, you know, occasionally someone that we just want to be totally done with, and so we take him way out in the middle of nowhere and we don't tell anyone where it is on a ship and drop the body in the ocean.
Lying with the fishes.
Because he was the big boogeyman, see, and you really need to treat him in that. Okay, let's really make sure that, you know, we don't want the ghost of the terrorist to haunt us either, right? You know, we don't mean it literally like they did back then, but, you know, we know if there's a grave somewhere that people can have pilgrimages they go to, right, the quote-unquote ghost of him is going to still haunt us. So you put him in an undisclosed location out in the depths of the ocean somewhere. Right, so we still play in these modes. Let's see, anything else there?
You got to be worried about an animal that ate a guy you're sure is going to come back.
Yeah, a whole bit of exposure to the body to be eaten by wild animals. See, for them to think that was okay, they had to have kind of left behind the notion that the soul is going to be absorbed into the animal, and then, you know, and then you're going to have a werewolf, like, you know, haunting you or something. Right? Obviously, that's a problematic one if you haven't gotten away from the more primitive notions. Let's see. I guess the only other thing I want to emphasize there is just the way they talked about that. You know, began to devise methods. You know, many techniques were developed. That whole elaboration thing that they're talking about. You know, this requires quote unquote higher spiritual methods, right? That's and just, I mean, a simple way you can appreciate how this works, say in Christianity, is, you know, get into the technical terms that Christian theologians use, and then your eyes will start glazing over. There's all these different terms, you know, of is this propitiation or is this reconciliation? Is this, you know, I mean, just on and on and on. They have all these terms that have very precise meanings because there's this whole precise, elaborate scheme. You know, and all those words get attached to the interpreting Jesus, you know, and Jesus is, you know, is the Redeemer or, you know, et cetera. You take these ghost cult terms and you apply them to Jesus in certain specific ways. And you now have the correct understanding of redemption or, well, whatever. all right, let's keep going.
Ghosts were supposed to be disturbed and frightened by noise. Shouting, bells, and drums drove them away from the living. And these ancient methods are still in vogue at wakes for the dead. Foul-smelling concoctions were utilized to banish unwelcome spirits. Hideous images of the spirits were constructed so that they would flee in haste when they beheld themselves. It was believed that dogs could detect the approach of ghosts and that they gave warning by howling. That cocks would crow when they were near. The use of a cock as a weather vane is in perpetuation of this superstition.
Ooh, an ill wind doth blow. All right? If you ever wondered why it was a rooster in that weather vane. Think about all of the traditions, you know, especially in the more barbarous modes on the world, you know, where you have hideous images of spirits. You know, all kinds of different cultures have all kinds of, you know, that hideous image modality. Or just foul-smelling concoctions. Oh, yeah, that's why you hang garlic around your neck to keep the vampires away or whatever. See, all of those thoughts. See, and again, all this is trying to remind you between the lines is, oh, yeah, it's all outer life rationalization stuff projected into this illusory spirit world. Or ghost world. See, there's nothing here about the inner life that Jesus came 2,000 years ago to try to get us to think about. And it's sad to record that no one is yet. He tried, but everyone is still in this exalted outer life scheme, and we still can't recognize that all you need is faith. It's like, well, it can't be that. Well, no, I'm not talking about credulous belief. Of course it can't be just that. You kind of know that, you know. but the answer to it, it's not just credulous belief, isn't, well, it has to be a whole certain way I move my body or rearrange molecules or something. Whether or not I cleaned the altar or something. I mean, I don't want to be totally dismissive here, but it's not that we shouldn't do things in the outer life, but it has nothing to do with spirit, like Jesus was trying to say. Right? It's about time, the outer life. Spirit is about eternity.
But I thought the outer life is a reflection of the inner life.
Yeah.
But
seek first the kingdom of heaven. You know, he didn't say seek only.
Right.
See, that's right. It's just you want to get something besides. See, I mean, even if the upper domain hasn't been polluted at all, even if you're still effectively that innocent 6-year-old that was encircled in the Holy Spirit, and that your outer life is predicated on that innocent upper domain of that six-year-old, again, that's just a child of God. And God expects you to grow up at some point, mm-hmm. right? So even if there isn't any pollution, right, there's still an issue of immaturity. But even more so, what if I've unwittingly drug a whole bunch of stuff up there? And like you're saying, the outer life is going to be inescapably predicated on what's up there. If I've taken religious dogma and put it up there, that controls my conduct. You know, and you do want your conduct controlled, but you want it to be controlled in conformity with the cosmos, not in conformity with some clever scheme that humans have dreamt up about how to placate ghosts or something. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be a big problem because who knows anything about the cosmos?
Yeah, who knows? you know, and even with the revelation, you know, it still comes down to the fact that I can't build myself. This better predicate I'm talking about is grown in me, not built by me. So I can read and read and read and analyze, but I'm not going to get delusional and think that I can build my better predicate. All I can do is supply favorable conditions. Like trying to reflecting on the words in the book is a favorable condition. You will be grown, and you have to just let that happen. Because we don't know the physics of the cosmos. I mean, it's just another reason why, obviously I can't build it. I have no idea what the specs are of the cosmos. Right? It's just a word. But there are specs, and the God of evolution knows the specs and will grow you to spec.
Well, you've made a lot of diagrams that are pretty specful.
Yes, right? I've made lots of diagrams, they're reflection aids, mm-hmm. right? They aren't blueprints for building a better you. Right?
Yeah, but they still reflect with the cosmos, how yes. it works and everything.
Yes. And the more that you synchronize with how that works, you're putting your mind in a frame where, coincidentally, what needs to be grown there kind of fits right into that. Right? Round peg, round hole. Right? So that reflecting on the things, it helps, right? To make it so that what they want, what the builders want to put in there, naturally locks in.
It makes makes you wonder about like Enoch and Elijah. I mean, they're completely submersed
mm-hmm. in the ghost cult.
Maybe not even very much advancing ghost cult.
Yeah. No, we touch upon this all the time. There's a lot of mystery to someone way, 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 way back fusing. And I don't claim to fully understand that. Because, again, see, it gets to this, I don't have the specs. And so I can't really speak with any authority about it. I can reflect a little bit, and I can appreciate that there's some relativity to this. They're fusing, back then, not during the first stage of light and life. It's just like when they say, you start reading about light and life, and say, well, finally there's pretty significant numbers getting to third circular. And you're going, what? All right, but you got to remind yourself, okay, there's some relativity there. To him who much is given is much expected. To him who not much is given, think Enoch, right? Less is expected. Right? There's some relativity to this. I can't speak to the details of it, but I know there is some relativity there.
Well,
even Jesus got to the point where he could have
used. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, compared to us, you know, he still didn't know about his previous history.
Mm-hmm.
He was true man at that point.
Yep. You know, little Jesus didn't have the Urantia book, right? You know, he had the services in the Jewish services in the synagogue. You know, were just glorified ghost cult. And he had all of the primitiveness of the world around him. Now, you know, one of the key elements there that accelerated that process for him is a very, very, very supreme adjuster to speed up the process. But obviously, you know, no matter how efficiently the adjuster can catalyze the situation, if Jesus hadn't supplied the favorable conditions, nothing would have happened. The adjuster is always subservient to your will, no matter how fancy it is.
No.
You know?
His personality you're talking about. Something
you need. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, let's see. Where were we? The water one? Yeah, okay.
Water was regarded as the best protection against ghosts. Holy water was superior to all other forms. Water in which the priests had washed their feet. Both fire and water were believed to constitute impassable barriers to ghosts. The Romans carried water three times around the corpse. In the 20th century, the body is sprinkled with holy water, and hand washing at the cemetery is still a Jewish ritual. Baptism was a feature of the later water ritual. Primitive bathing was a religious ceremony. Only in recent times has bathing become a sanitary practice.
Of course, I think everyone remembers how the prince's staff 500,000 years ago was, you know, trying to, you know, teach hygiene, you know, and really couldn't get very far. And so they had to kind of amp up the religious notions to increase the amount of bathing. And eventually that leads to Jesus having to give an epical sermon in Capernaum about the difference between clean hands and clean hearts. And it's like, well, how did those Jews get so fixated on clean hands? Well, it goes back to Lut and crew going, well, you know, I think the only way we're going to be able to do this is just to amp up the, you know, the woo-woo notion about water. So it's all part of this process. But again, it was appropriate back then. But see, by the time you get to Jesus' time, all good things had been taken to an extreme and become bad, and Jesus had to confront it very directly. And this whole bit about water, which the priests had, you know, in which the priests had washed their feet, boy, it just changes the whole sensibility when you see someone, you know, in some period piece, you know. You know, wanting to really protect themselves and taking a big swig of holy water. Yum, yum.
I think it's flammable.
Yeah. All right, keep going.
But man did not stop with ghost coercion. Through religious ritual and other practices, he was soon attempting to compel spirit action. Exorcism was the employment of one spirit to control or banish another, and these tactics were also utilized for frightening ghosts and spirits. The dual spiritism concept of good and bad forces offered man ample opportunity to attempt to pit one agency against another, for if a powerful man could vanquish a weaker one, then certainly a strong spirit could dominate an inferior ghost. Primitive cursing was a coercive practice designed to overawe minor spirits. Later, this custom expanded into the pronouncing of curses upon enemies.
Yeah, remember how impacted they are by, you know, loud noises, and boy, if you swear a blue streak at them, you know, they're just totally overawed, and, and it's pretty funny. Yeah. But again, you go, oh, of course, they're thinking about the way humans are and react and behave, and see, Right, they're just projecting it into the, like I've been saying over and over again, this is all outer life notions transferred into spirit land. If they could rationalize it in their experience, then that validated it. Like they're saying, for if a powerful man could vanquish a weaker one, then certainly, right, a strong spirit could dominate an inferior ghost, right? And you go, oh, well, that's, how do you know that's true? Well, it's obviously a correct understanding, isn't it? Because, right? I mean, isn't that not the way it works with a powerful man and a weaker one? See, QED. That whole correct understanding thing, you can see is between the lines there, what was considered truth. All right. Yep.
But there is something about the spirit domain that is mysterious to a human,
mm-hmm.
and that is the hierarchy and the apparent subservience of the lower orders to the higher orders.
Yeah.
How does that work? I have no clue.
Yeah. Well, and we all know that that subservience can be a problem if the system sovereign goes astray and leads all the angels over the cliff with him. All right, keep going here.
It was long believed that by reverting to the usages of the more ancient mores, the spirits and demigods could be forced into desirable action. Modern man is guilty of the same procedure. You address one another in common everyday language, but when you engage in prayer, you resort to the older style of another generation, the so-called solemn style.
Okay, so again, we haven't gotten to prayer full on, but they just toss in a little thing. I mean, I told you how they're trying to soften a little bit because this is such a sensitive subject, but they eventually want you to face this head on. I mean, prayer, yes. Coercion, no. Right? See, you think you know what the word prayer in the Urantia book means. No, you don't. The word prayer is defined in the ghost cult for you. You don't have any idea of what prayer is. Really. Right? You know, you go into a solemn style, quote unquote. You know, or you might even say it in King James Version. You know, and then it's really powerful. Or, you know, like, you know, you hear me joke all the time. You know, if you really want to control the spirits, say it in Latin. Okay, then you have them totally surrounded when you say it in Latin.
Checkmate.
They have to do everything, you know, you compel them to do after that. Right? And that's all over, like, you know, in our super, quote unquote, supernatural stories, right? You know, and like I said, so often those stories go away from vampires and werewolves and stuff and get into God and demons, and you know, and it's in the same mode. You know, you're not going to stop the Antichrist, you know, speaking Swahili. You got to say Latin, okay? Right? All right. See, and again, just that, see, and notice how they're just being gentle, getting you to think about the way you pray. But, you know, eventually they want you to think about just your whole notion of the praying itself. You know, you're trying to get God at least favorably disposed, and maybe you're trying to get him to be actively engaged with you in some project. Or if not God, at least the angels. Yeah.
So the truth thread in prayer then would be the communicating with the Creator?
The beginnings of the truth thread are the fact that you might actually prostrate yourself, for instance, or something, or at least go out on a knee or something. The humility, right? Yeah. all everything you say and think and whatnot may be completely beside the point. The favorable condition might just be the humility that you've imposed upon yourself. That's a favorable condition. Loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient.
You're not very humble when you're coercing someone.
Yeah, right. But see that should get you to think, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. You see, so you're trying to trick God. See, you're actually trying to bribe him or coerce him or something, but you're going to trick him by going down on one knee so he thinks you're humble. But really, you're scheming. But, you know, like we just read, I mean, you know, God, I mean, they aren't, you know, God isn't too smart. I mean, you know, loud noises will scare him away, you know. right? I mean, see, we're in that mode still, where you think you can fool him by, you know, by bowing your head or folding your hands or, you know, going on your knees or, and that proves the humility of your prayer.
It does sound like a little kid, doesn't it?
Yes. It's a little kid thought. But again, it has its place in an evolutionary or developmental process. It's a beginning, but boy, oh boy, is it not an ending. Okay.
This doctrine also explains many religious ritual reversions of a sex nature, such as temple prostitution. These reversions to primitive customs were considered sure guards against many calamities. And with these simple-minded peoples, all such performances were entirely free from what modern man would term promiscuity.
You know, lack of biologic uplift, you know, kind of just helps with that, where you think of sex in a more matter-of-fact fashion. You know, and again, just think, you know, the power of, of sexual-related things to impact, you know, the good and bad forces. I mean, you know, again, when we tell stories, say, about vampires, don't be surprised if there's sex, you know, involved in our story about vampires, say. Because they do that old-time, powerful mojo stuff, see? Like they're talking about here. Because, you know, the bad ones are always lower in the hierarchy and are going to be doing the more old-time religion things than the higher ones. And that's why you have those moral codes against sexual, you know, issues, you know, when you're trying to relate to the higher spirits. You know, see, all that stuff is the ghost cult rationalization, the way we tell all these stories and stuff.
Next came the practice of ritual vows, soon to be followed by religious pledges and sacred oaths. Most of these oaths were accompanied by self-torture and self-mutilation, later on by fasting and prayer. Self-denial was subsequently looked upon as being a sure coercive. This was especially true in the matter of sex suppression. And so primitive man early developed a decided austerity in his religious practices, a belief in the efficacy of self-torture and self-denial as rituals capable of coercing the unwilling spirits to react favorably toward all such suffering and deprivation.
Right. Or as rituals capable of coercing the unwilling God to react favorably toward all such suffering and deprivation. And you notice how they threw it in there again. Oh yeah, boy, primitive, self-torture and self-mutilation. Now called fasting and prayer. Ouch. Right? You can see how they're starting to poke a little bit harder to challenge you. What do you think the word prayer refers to? Do you really know what prayer is? That thing that the book talks about as being very effective and leads you up to thanks, you know, up to Thanksgiving and through Thanksgiving to worship. That prayer, do you really know what that prayer is that leads you up like that? Or do you have some fancy, self-deceptive, coercive notion about prayer? You know, you got to love that expression. You know, self-denial was subsequently looked upon as being a sure coercive. I mean, boy, if I deny myself a little bit, I mean, God is helpless. I mean, yeah, he's got to give me what I want then. You know, I'll give up something for Lent. And then he's screwed. I mean, just think how silly this is when you just unpack it, right, out loud. You know, and take away the solemn style thought about it, right? All that false reverence we attach to these things.
I don't know. There was something about the ash on the forehead that I liked.
Yeah,
that was it.
See, now, but now again, because I'm being so harsh. I need to reiterate it. No, these things have their place with the children of God. It's like, well, then why is the Urantia book being so hard on these things? Because this is a book for future adults of God. Jesus was talking to the children of God. The Urantia book is talking to the future adults of God. Right? all right, let's see if we can finish up here.
Modern man no longer attempts openly to coerce the spirits, though he still evinces a disposition to bargain with deity. And he still swears, knocks on wood, crosses his fingers, and follows expectoration with some trite phrase. Once it was a magical formula.
yes, and but, of course, Jesus, you couldn't totally reject that. He did the spit thing, you know, because people were expecting it. And
but we're going to say bargain with deity in this.
Yeah, right. That's what I was just going to bring up before we wrap it up. Though he still evinces a disposition to bargain with deity. My plane went down in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. All my crew died. I'm the only one that made it through, just barely. I'm floating in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean in a life raft. And I've kind of found God in the baking sun. And I set up a bargain. God, if you'll spare me, if somehow you'll get me to land and people, food and water, I promise you I'll dedicate the rest of my life in service to you. Bargaining with deity. You know, and stories like that are some of our most cherished stories. You know, we feel mightily moved when we watch a well-done movie about someone who went through that story.
But there is some good in that.
There's the thing. See, that's the tension. You know there's something appropriate about that. Yeah, to children of God.
That they're going to dedicate their life.
Right.
That was the good stuff.
Yeah. But it just reminds you, wow. So the Urantia book is saying, yeah, okay, yeah, that's something. But you could be so much more. So much more, Lord? I don't understand. How can I possibly be more than the person that I hold up as like one of the greatest examples of a God-fearing person that's ever lived? Yeah, a God-fearing person. Right? See, I know I've been beating it and beating it, but there's all these different ways where you can begin to recognize I really don't know what it is that the Urantia book is wanting me to achieve. I'm not sure I have any idea what it's talking about, where it wants me to go. Yeah, that's step one, is to let go of all the false illusions of success. Warning, not for those timid souls who can only keep up the struggle of life by the aid of continuous false illusions of success. All right. The book is not for timid souls. It's not for children of God. Basic children of God are timid souls, inescapably. And you have false illusions of success. I've successfully conducted myself correctly. I've successfully understood correctly. I've done my duty. Duty, compulsion, or convention. Right? Yeah, but there's so much more. There's second miler. And you don't know what that's talking about. You can't point to anyone. It's something that's completely outside the ghost cult that you're unfamiliar with.
We may not recognize them.
Right? As a matter of fact, you know, technically you could point to someone, Jesus, but everyone thought he was beside himself. Right? If there's a second miler somewhere, everyone will think he's crazy because he doesn't fit in the ghost cult. But the person that, you know, fits into the ghost cult in spades, they get sainted. Okay? Right? But then, of course, you have to distinguish between those who are genuinely psychotic and those people just think are crazy. Jesus was not psychotic, but everyone was certain he was, including his family. Thought he was just totally off his rocker. Like, Mary, seriously, how could you think that your son was psychotic? Gabriel came and visited you directly. I mean, how? Right? How could you possibly think he's psychotic? Anyway, so that's the challenge. We'll next time we'll do this final section in this paper on the nature of cultism. You're going to speak to this a little bit, and one of the things that's in play is, again, there's a place for an even more sophisticated cult, because the main evolutionary stream is kind of has to keep chugging along. But then there's you, possibly, that could stand apart, right, and not be limited by that glacial progression in spite of itself process. Right? Okay, so yeah, we'll get that, and then you'll see we'll move right into more of the details. You know, this ever more complex thing. You've got fetishes, charms, and magic. We've got all of that complexity we have to bring in next to. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.